Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Robert Damashek, Chief Architect, Binary Group, and noted International Enterprise Architecture Authority. Now, Robert, thank you for coming in today and sharing your many deep experiences with the audience.
You're welcome, Steve. I'm very honored to have this opportunity to discuss challenges and solutions that we're seeing and that are vital to addressing large-scale change in enterprise initiatives in government.
Now, Robert, you've got this amazing background. You know, you've done a lot over many years, and as I mentioned, you're an international noted enterprise architecture authority, an ICT authority as well. So can you talk more about your role with the Binary Group and describe the value to industry and professionals?
Sure. I'm the chief architect at Binary Group. I've been with the company for about 11 years, and I lead our Center of Excellence in Enterprise Architecture and Software, in which we develop unique methods for use with our clients. And I also apply them in our enterprise architecture practice. And over the past couple of years, we've been stepping back a little from enterprise architecture and looking at what our clients have been needing. And so we developed a unique outcome-driven approach that blends and fuses some of the best practices and applications from Gartner, O&B, the Office of Management and Budget and the federal government, and the Agile Development Community, so that we can apply it to architecture and enterprise architecture and deliver things basically in the life cycle and in the decision cycle for senior leaders. So we're taking the same principles of being able to develop software rapidly and being outcome driven so that we're focusing on the challenges that leaders have, and we're applying it to architecture development. So Gartner believes that our approach is the first to define outcome-driven planning as a new method that really steps outside the IT origins of enterprise architecture. And we're the first to bring this to government. And we're applying it to all kinds of initiatives. And I think it's very applicable to any place where there is enterprise change, from enhancing use of shared services, innovation challenges, what we're doing for a couple of clients, to providing new insights for trying to get help to veterans early on so that they don't become homeless, for example, to even enhancing the analytical capabilities of the Army's financial management units. So it's an approach that we call ODEA, an outcome-driven enterprise approach. And it really focuses on planning and how architects can become a team member of the planning process and strategic planning. And also as chief architect, I do provide thought leadership to clients to help demystify new and disruptive technologies, to help them provide benefits to their missions and help avoid the challenges that happen where people tend to gravitate to what they know versus new technologies that are inherently risky and scary. So we do pilots and proof of concept applications to help clients better understand the value and the usefulness and where they can apply new technologies, which include things like semantics and natural language processing and big data for medical research problems and augmented reality and responsive design for location-aware service navigation, which we're applying to the population health problem, and including even dynamic case management, which is when you've got cross-jurisdictional or cross-agency kind of planning that you need to go in support of a client.
Now, it's interesting. You've got this tremendous background, as I mentioned, and which covers so many years. For example, you have your work with the Army CIO, the Department of Defense CIO, the OMB Chief Architect. So from all of that experience then, what are your top tips for developing an integrated common approach to EA or enterprise architecture?
I think the first tip is don't continue to do the same things that failed. That the a lot of the times, you know, we get, as practitioners, we get very comfortable with activities and practices, frameworks, for example, and developing huge architectures that in reality sit on the shelf and don't inform any critical decisions and are not a main tool for moving the strategic planning of the enterprise. So that's the first one. Don't make it a compliance exercise. In terms of the second tip, I think we need to learn how to think from the outside in. And that's mission focus. Become a trusted planner, strategic planning partner that has the ability to help with enterprise change, rather than being inside out, IT driven, or focused on purely architectural concerns. I was part of the team that worked the collaborative planning methodology for the Office of Management Budget at the federal government level. And we worked hard to remove the architecture word, the A word we call it, entirely from the method. What we wanted to be is to use the rigor of architecture as a tool to help enhance planning, but we want to just be a member of the planning team, and a trusted member and an advisor, a strategic advisor. Then the third tip, I would focus like a laser on mission outcomes. How do you find mission outcomes and how do you balance those across stakeholders? That's the first thing. Then examine, well, okay, so how can technology be applied to this, and how can we prioritize things so that we can deliver them incrementally? So for an example, we've looked at how you can apply ideation and innovation at NASA and elsewhere to help with space mission outcomes, given that they're in a tight budget situation. First, focus on what's the mission? How is it going to help the mission? And then introduce tools or information technologies. Another tip is become expert at understanding and articulating costs and risks that are involved when you don't change. It can be a very tremendous motivator if you can articulate the cost of not changing. And you can engage stakeholders and say, you know, you're losing $1 million a month if you don't do this. So it's a critical tool that can help you move even to a point where you're just looking at a strategy to find out, is it viable? Fail early if it's not viable, and then the costs and the risks are very easy to manage, and you can change your approach. If you're applying an agile approach to your thinking, then choose something else. It's not the only thing on the table. And then my last tip is to deliver things rapidly, which relates to the previous one. Deliver insights to decision makers within their decision cycles. That's how you can become a trusted advisor. If you help out, you get called back to help out again. And what I've seen is that enterprise architecture has become isolated, and we can't become isolated. We shouldn't be inside of the IT organization, because it's a discipline that helps the enterprise as a whole.
Now, you got this, as I indicated earlier, just a remarkable background of contribution and success, and one of which is with the Federal Open Government Initiative. Can you talk about some of your tips from that work with the Federal Open Government Initiative in terms of strategies and technologies to enhance transparency, collaboration, and outcomes?
Yes, I'm personally very interested. I believe in a collaborative open government. I think we've reached a level of complexity, as evidenced from things like healthcare.gov and others, where it's just beyond the beyond. It's extremely difficult for our leaders to govern such a complex enterprise. So open government means opening it up to more eyes, opening it up to across silos that in the past have been blocked. And so my tips there relate to how can you look at leadership challenges where they're dealing with this kind of complexity. It's becoming so overwhelming that they're stuck, and it stands in the way of responding to new disruptions, which may come from things like the OMB and the president asking for greater transparency or greater openness. One of the recent things is open sharing of research that's publicly funded. Now, how can you use that as an opportunity to enhance the outcomes that matter for leaders? And it may relate to changes for their mission. It may relate to changes for the career. If they embrace it wholeheartedly and become champions, then it can become a major. They can become a champion for you, and you can become an aid in helping increase transparency in a way that helps the mission of the agency. Versus the president has a vision, and it's largely and often an unfunded mandate. And unless really it becomes an element of the mission itself, it's difficult to really engage the enterprise. So I have an example in a recent discussion we had with an Army colonel who commands the training of a major functional mission area for the Army. And he's concerned with, he's got a new requirement. In this case, it's a DOD-wide. It's an open sharing kind of requirement. It's a open government kind of requirement. But it's forcing a change in the fundamental practice of the enterprise to where people who are trained have to get ongoing learning, continuous learning. Well, is that that sort of happens in a lot of professions, but it's somewhat new to government. So what he wants to do is to help his people in this process, use this as an opportunity to help them think more holistically about how they influence, performing their mission, how do they play in the whole overall process, so that they can focus better on tracking and enhancing mission performance. And so they can step, it's really part, I think of it as part of the shift to thinking about outcomes. They step outside of activities. These are his words. He wants them to stop thinking about activities and start thinking about outcomes and performance. And this colonel knows that the Army needs this. The DOD and the Army as a whole is under tremendous financial pressure, which is not expected to go away. Even if there's some change in the whole sequestration process, there's still going to be an era of ever-tightening budgets. And the more that his staff and personnel can think about the problem and think about how they can contribute, the better. Large organizations get inefficient. That's just sort of part and parcel of their fundamental nature. So that's an example of an innovator who is trying to leverage disruptions like that are coming from the outside about openness and turn them into practical opportunities. So the second tip I would have is embrace openness as a mission enabler, but not as lip service, because agencies do a lot of activities, but they may not necessarily be taking the right actions that lead to meaningful outcomes for their mission. So using these disruptions as opportunities to move the enterprise to get better performance, the enterprise can become less crisis-driven or reactive and become more performance-driven. This is very much tied to the previous one where the colonel has seen this. He wants his staff to embrace analytics and the insight it gives. A good example is the Environmental Protection Agency, which has become a pioneer and fully embraced open data exchange, particularly because their mission touches all these locales, states and local origin tribes and cities, because of the need to track environmental change and to across a variety of different disciplines. So they had to think from the outside in. They had to think of how they shared information to make it meaningful for their stakeholders. They're not there like everyone else. They have their challenges, but they're a good example of an agency that gets it overall. Then a third tip I would have is use cross-stakeholder workshops to engage participation, to where the openness helps drive out common outcomes. And a good example I have there is Kshemendra Paul leads a group at DHS, and their mission is to focus on creating an information sharing environment around counterterrorism. And he has done a tremendous job at making these mission-driven workshops, creating interagency workshops to help focus on outcomes and get people on the same page and then drive change based on that. Our process, ODEA, uses workshops as an integral tool for rapidly discovering and aligning outcomes, which we do in a discovery phase, and then understanding what you have to analyze in order to support the decisions around those outcomes. What are the changes? What do you need to analyze in order to give you an idea of what to change and what's practical to change? We call that our decision strategy phase. And then you identify the analytical insights that help drive decision cycles, which is an analytics delivery phase. And through the iterating through that cycle of these three phases, you get insights into how you're actually going to plan a roadmap for change. What can you do that's practical that you can do tomorrow? Or what's dependent on other things that need to be done later? And so we have built into this fundamental underlying element that we've had in enterprise architecture of understanding where we are, understanding where we want to go first, and then understanding where we are and then building a roadmap for change. But it's done very, very in granular and in increments, so it's not so it meets and sits within the decision cycle of the leadership. And then another point I would bring out is that we should look for ways to incrementally influence over open government. So it's sort of the idea of thinking globally but acting locally. So you build trust within smaller localized community rather than through large-scale initiatives of trying to do something that's boiling the ocean. That's a major thrust. You achieve the value for people in localities and then expand it. And a good example I have there is the e-diplomacy initiative at Department of State, where they've held these local workshops in many foreign countries to demonstrate ways that they could embrace openness using social media. And it breaks the ice. It helps give those people clues. You come to them, and it's acting locally with a vision of global change. And then from a technology side, I think people should leave big data in place whenever possible. Big data is a challenge area that I think all agencies are going to face at some point in time. Some are beginning to grapple with it in a big way, and have had to for their missions, like some elements of the intelligence community, for example. But there have been challenges with applying a data warehouse approach to big data. It's proven not to work. And it's been widely documented. And instead, we're doing, and I think I can point to, we did some pioneering work for the DOD as a joint Army DOD effort that then led to the DOD's chief management office focusing on federating the problem, going to the sources, keeping the sources of the data in place, but federating across the domain. In this case, it was human services or human resources and the health domain and information sharing across the military services and the VA. And they were able to do it practically and incrementally because they left the data in place. So that as enterprise architects, we get exposed to new technologies, and we have to think about how to apply them practically in a large enterprise. And in, I fundamentally believe that there's a way to do big data, and there's a way to apply semantics as a as an integrating tool across big data. And there's been a few examples, and in fact, the intelligence community has is recently brought out a capability around what they call the DI2E, or it's a cloud-based solution that uses semantics, and where the technology sits behind the firewalls in place where it exists, and so all the security controls exist, and yet you can use natural language processing queries that give results and federate across all of the nodes involved, and it scales and it performs well and it gets results for people. And we need to be thinking about solutions like that that are practical, are cost effective, and will scale to the size of the enterprises we're dealing with.
Robert, beyond what we have discussed already, can you describe some of your prior roles and some lessons from each role that would be of high value to the audience?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I for many years supported the Enterprise Architecture group, which part of the Army CIO G6, and then supported the DoD CIO and the Office of Management and Budget as well. At federal level, one of the challenges I've seen. Basically, provided enterprise architect. My role was as an enterprise architecture advisor, strategic advisor to those organizations. What I saw, as the lessons learned from the Army, is a tremendous cost of not having ready access to the intelligence of the enterprise in time to meet the decision maker cycle. So that ties into why we've come up with this whole approach of trying to meet the decision maker cycle. What I saw is the Army would go through these exercises over and over and over again that would pull in the cast of thousands. So we had before even the cloud and data center consolidation became a big thrust, we had a concept called the Army Processing Center. And the Army is trying to do basically data center consolidation, effectively move to standardized processing centers and do more with these centralized facilities than the widely distributed set of resources they had. And to come up with ideas and to deal with them across a large-scale enterprise is impractical. It's really difficult. It requires, and to do so within the decision maker cycle. So for example, the leadership of the Army the Vice Chief of Staff had a problem. They were trying to figure out how to deal with this Army network and try to consolidate it. And the only way they could get answers, because the knowledge was totally diffused across large organizations, many different silos, and that was widely geographically distributed, is they would call, bring people in for a week or two to totally brainstorm it and come up with a solution. The information wasn't available for the leaders in any way possible that they could get reasonable results. And just as a large bureaucracy. So that's a lesson learned. There needs to be a new way to deal with problems like this so that enterprise leaders, whatever scale enterprise they're dealing with, have the intelligence that they need to make decisions rapidly. And that another lesson learned is that not having common semantics really sustains silos. It sustains silos. It allows infighting to get in the way of rational thinking and objective thinking. For example, I was involved in the answering a question that came up during the Quadrennial Defense Review, which is the DoD's annual 5-year budget planning cycle and looking at strategic issues and determining where they're going to focus their initiatives. Well, it came up because there was a difference in there was lack of clarity in the way that DoD and the Army were thinking about shared services. One in an environment that was going to be tactically deployed to like mobile devices and low bandwidth kinds of environments that can come up in the battlefield, and the other that was being deployed at an enterprise level where you had huge bandwidth and total capacity and things, networks that didn't go down. And because they use similar terminology, the people who were looking at the budget said, well, these two things are the same. Let's cut one and let's cut the Army's program and throw all the money over to DOD, and in this case it was the Defense Information Services Agency, DISA, and said, let them do it. Well, it turned out that, you know, the way that you architect something for a low bandwidth, a handheld environment, you know, that would work on a iPhone, for example, is very different than the way that you architect something. Even though they have things in common functionally, they were architected extremely different and had very different constraints to think about. So just because we didn't have a common way of thinking about these technologies and understanding where they were to be used, that causes confusion. And in a large enterprise, nobody's really able to know how to apply the resources and how to make good decisions without thinking about the architecture. So it turns out we were able to provide some insight about the different architectures, and the DoD ended up taking some money away from DISA and giving it to the Army. So that was a big win for us. But really, when it came down to it, both programs had value and both were doing different things. So that's another lesson learned. And at the OMB level, this whole idea of collaborative planning, frameworks and tools and architecture methods are just that. There are tools to support decision making, timely analysis and decision making. And we need to think about this as a discipline that will go into the strategic planning offices of our enterprises, or into the folks who are thinking about the new and latest strategies. We've had examples of strategies that have had a lot of visibility and they haven't really quite worked in the last few years. So what we need to do is to help those processes along. We can't just be part of the CIO shop where CIOs are becoming more relegated to commodity IT decisions. We need to be able to think of the problem as a strategic planning problem, and we need to be able to leverage architectural knowledge, which comes from a variety of sources, and apply it to assessing strategies. Are these strategies practical? How do we know what steps can we take to assess the viability? Can we do little agile pilot efforts and fail early if we need to fail? So those are three lessons learned that I've from the different roles I've had at the Army and the DoD and at the OMB level that I think are critical for architects to consider. I've also seen some interesting things happening from trying to introduce technology that is disruptive and it's strategic. For example, I was part as a company, we decided to expand beyond DoD and the Army and a number of our major clients and to working with VA and other kinds of population health considerations. And we found this effort called Project Reach, which was a VA HUD effort. And it turned out that we needed to, what I learned from that effort, which was that it's very important to understand both the mission and what kinds of tolerance for risk and cost that your stakeholders have. And in this case, neither the VA nor HUD was very clear on their requirements or what was acceptable to them in terms of risk and cost. They created a challenge, which is part of challenge.gov. The whole part of the thrust of open government is to create these challenges and challenge the community at large to come up with solutions that could potentially have great value for government. And somewhat part of the nature of a challenge, they weren't very clear on requirements. They enhanced the creativity in the solutions proposed, but they also allowed pretty unpractical path to be followed, which became too obvious late in the project, and too late to really turn them around. What we've done in applying ODAA, it allows us to raise these issues up front, to get clear on outcomes, get clear on constraints and risks, and clear on the specific capabilities and what's most important. And we just didn't really understand how scary new technology would be. Even though this effort was funded by an agency innovation center, they had their boundaries on how far they could go in accepting new technology. So that was an eye-opener and lesson learned that I've also learned from working in this community.
Robert, you've already talked about and somewhat spotlighted some of these already, but are there some additional top challenges you have faced and your solutions to those challenges?
Yeah, I mean, one is one that we've personally, the company Binary Group has personally dealt with, and a lot of contractors and consultants and providers in the government space have dealt with these tremendous challenge of the government reductions. We're faced, basically what happened at the DoD CIO was that our client got a 60% budget cut. And so what happens to all these folks who are doing all these activities and roles is they just decided what was minimally essential and then they cut everything else. So what we had to do was think about the survival of our profession as enterprise architects and the fact that we weren't delivering the value fast enough for strategic leaders, at least fast enough that they considered it important enough to keep us around. And so we faced that by embracing the change. Our solution was, okay, there's something going on here under the surface. You know, we're here to serve. A client has a need, and we're here to serve. And we're not here to just do activities just to do them. We're here to make sure that what we're delivering is of value. So what we did is we reinvented our practice. And as I mentioned, some things about ODA, our whole process, our tools and the way that we do it, and particularly how fast we do it and how we can retain it to be robust but fast. It's good enough. It's just in time. And it's just enough architecture. And so that was a challenge that, you know, really was a challenge to our survival as practitioners and as an organization. And in the process, we found, gosh, you know, architecture is all about planning and doing good planning. Well, everybody does planning. Right? And so it's applicable to all of our practices. We've applied it in financial management, in training, in cybersecurity, and in the intelligence community, and in some specific challenges there, applying it in medical research and population health. And it's great because suddenly now we're able to see the EA role as an essential element of how you do planning. And we're able to have impact, and we're able to communicate to strategic leaders in a way that we were never able to do before. So that challenge, I think, has been good for us, though it was painful. this whole idea of making architecture relevant by being much more analytical and objective. We had a client with Army's 20th Support Command, which had this mission, which is a big, important one, related to chemical, biological, radiological defense and remediation overseas. And yet, because it was a new mission, and because they had specific constraints of how fast they had to deploy to regions, they were using a lot of commercial satellite communications. And it was the only way that they could think of doing it. But we found a way to look at the overall problem and look at their processes and say, okay, well, during a certain window, you need this commercial SATCOM, but most of the time you don't. And what happened was we could prove, because we had done the analysis of looking at the organizational needs and determining how much support they needed and how much communication support they needed, that we could save the Army about $50 million over the 5-year period. So finally, we had somebody from the planning and budgeting side of the Army come and say, this is the first time I've ever had architecture produce results for me. You know, it was his challenge. He couldn't afford to do this. The Army couldn't afford to keep paying commercial SATCOM rates when they only needed it a small portion of the time. And they were able then to use the military capabilities during a large portion of the mission. And so that's getting down to an outcome that's needed. It needed to be done fast enough so that he could plan, it could hit the budgeting cycle with the POM period, as they call it in the federal government. And we did it. We did it. And it made architecture tangible for folks. Another challenge that we face is breaking down silos of communications across agencies. In that Project Reach effort, I mentioned that Homeless Connections, which was the product that we produced, was built for the very purpose of connecting communities, connecting homeless and the care providers and caseworkers who are working with homeless with the services that were available from the community and available locally to help people overcome issues with homelessness and prevent homelessness. And that's what we're moving forward with the VA and a new effort that we started this year to roll that out to some 37 cities over the next 2 years and localities in 10 states. And so the capability there is breaking down silos of communications across agencies. When you get down to fundamental needs, focus on the fundamental needs of citizens, it really quickly breaks down these organizational and siloed barriers. And we were able to bring folks together who never really knew what they did. Real good example was with the Bon Jovi organization. I think I'll bring that up a little later. I think it's a real interesting analogy and something that people can think about when they're working with their organizations.
Robert, you've talked about all of the different projects and insights that you've gained, and you've also shared with all these different agencies and so on. Do you have some recommended resource sites or links or perhaps your blog or other area or articles you publish that you can point to that where people can get more details?
Yeah, we certainly do have. We have a blog, which you referenced, and it's at, if you go to our website at www.binarygroup.com, you'll see a link to our blog. That's a set of articles. We've tried to focus on fundamental issues and make them case study related, and to help demystify some of this stuff for people. The community itself is growing, and we're now engaged with the Association of Federation. The AFEI, for enterprise information, we're trying to work on we're planning to work on a workshop for the spring, in where we'll start to bring out these concepts and share them with folks and actually bring them through practical exercises. I mentioned Gartner. Gartner is a good source of thought about how to become outcome-driven. And at their Enterprise Architecture Conference, there were numerous kinds of references to things that they've seen with clients and that they're bringing out as potential approaches for people to look at. So this is an evolving community, and I see there's the OMB's practical guide, which was the practical guide to enterprise architecture, became the common approach to EA, and then the revision of the methodology has become the collaborative planning methodology. Those are two good insights documents to look at the federal level. We spend a bunch of time on those activities, finally breaking down the barriers between how DOD thought about enterprise architecture and how the rest of the federal government thought about enterprise architecture. And it just was an issue of legacy that DOD, since they build these large weapon systems, built their architecture method and the DOD architecture framework around how do you get people on the same page when you're trying to do a large scale design and acquisition process and make sure that things are consistently represented. So if one person looks at a particular kind of view or architectural artifact, that they could understand it regardless of what their field was. So DOD had spent a lot of time on how you make get the architecture artifacts and the data to hang together. And the people who worked on the Federal Segment of Architecture methodology, FSAM, spent a lot of time in how do you get the processes to work well? And how do you get collaboration? How do you get stakeholder buy-in and governance and all those? So when we finally saw that, you know, stood back a little and looked at the problem and how we all need to work together as part of this whole collaborative planning activity, we were able to break down those barriers and leverage some of DOD's preciseness and accuracy in the architecture data, and as well as the work the federal government had done in trying to get the communities together and get collaborative activities going. So it was a first, and it was something that a lot of people predicted never could happen. And so that's another good source to look at the what OMB has published in that area. And I think that there are ongoing activities. I was at a recent Enterprise Architecture Conference and speaking about this with John Zachman, who is like the grandfather, the father of enterprise architecture. People know of the Zachman framework, which really is a way of looking at the different dimensions of an architecture and separating those dimensions so that you can analyze one thing at a time and sort of control the complexity and then think about the transformations as things go from concept through to implementation and the different roles that get involved in the process. So there's work going on in through Zachman's organization. They are part of the FEAC. They bought FEAC as part of their the Zachman Institute. There's work going on at that level. There's work going on at in some of the different EA focused learning organizations and some of the online groups that support the evolution of the enterprise architecture practice. And people are coming to the same conclusions generally that we need to do architecture differently, and they're beginning to grapple with them.
So Robert, what would you say then are the challenges with EA and where it has failed, and maybe what are some of the shortcomings of the existing frameworks that are out there?
Yeah, I think that in some respects, what we've done with enterprise architecture is we've treated it similarly to the data warehouses. We've tried to take everything, including reference models and architectures that cross everything from strategy down to implementation, et cetera, all the way down the line, and capture all that knowledge with the same kind of tools, you know, with a consistent set of tools, and in a consistent way, and viewed with certain artifacts, and we've made the problem one of these that's common to huge data warehouses. They don't scale. They don't work as an enterprise solution. They take too long. It's the same thing that's happened with architecture, and people just do what they know how to do, and so they're continuing to do this. But we need to learn. So that's a big challenge. The large scale, massive enterprise architecture projects of the past, they've failed. What we need to do is think about it where we need access to that knowledge. And I talked about that before. We need to know how the enterprise is put together. But the knowledge, it's, for example, you know, if you've got a building you're trying to change, this is one analogy I think that Zuckman used that I really like, is that, you know, you got a building and you're trying to change it. You're sitting in a conference room or in a conference center in a large building, and you want to change it. You want to move the wall. Okay, so some walls are easier to move and some walls aren't. You need to know enough about the architecture in order to decide what's practical to change and what's not. So when we're tapping it, enterprise architecture, we need to tap it in a way that's practical. We can't just say we have to recreate the knowledge of the entire enterprise and put it in an enterprise architecture tool and then we can reason about it. It's just not practical. I think the intentions of EA were very good. It's the only practice that's rigorously mapped out how you transform between needs and solutions with a certain level of discipline and a certain level of detail so that you can actually reason about that cycle. But, you know, the difference is that decision maker cycles don't last 40 years. You know, they happen in days and in weeks. So we need as a practice to change that. So where it's failed is we've been too slow. We haven't been responsive enough. When I asked Steve Van Reckel, who's the federal CIO, about this, because some of the challenges that the ways he was proposing the government change in terms of openness and shared services and cloud and all, they're changing the enterprise. They require you to know how your enterprise is constructed. And he also said that EA was the only foundation that's allowed us to do it. But as yet, we have not, as a community, grappled with how do we change this paradigm. And I think we need to think about it in a way that's really different than what we've thought before. It just takes too long. It costs too much to re-engineer all the data that describes the enterprise. And the data is captured, you know, if you're in the planning stage, it's captured in one set of tools. If you're at the design stage, or the engineering stage, operational stage, performance management stage, they're all captured in these different silos and their different tools. And what we need to do is think about that as a federation problem. First off, we need to prioritize our outcomes and choose how to answer pressing decisions, to focus on the decisions. Address the analytics rapidly and incrementally and make it part of a roadmap to success. And then we can easily tap into, easily is an interesting thing. We can tap into, federate and fuse the data in a way that lets us support the analysis. That's what we've done in the ODAA process. So look, you know, you can build things incrementally and agilely, You don't have to do them monolithically in this way. There was an example, in CNN and elsewhere talked about 20-somethings who were from San Francisco. They went ahead and they solved this one important piece of the healthcare.gov puzzle in 3 days. But they did it by focusing on one problem, one area, which is matching, the available insurance plans for a particular location, a particular person and person's needs. So that was one part of the puzzle. And they were able to tap the data because the data had been made open and put together a simple app that got answers for people. And that's an example of thinking agilely and thinking how to break down the problem in a way that you can build a piece of it, and then you can build the next piece of it, and build, you know, focus on one set of outcomes that you know are important. People need to be able to find the plans that are available to them. They don't, you know, they also need to be able to apply for them. I mean, that's a critical element. And so, I'm not dissing, the healthcare.gov effort in any way. I realize how complex it was. And in fact, they're trying to, in some respects, boil an ocean when the ocean was changing dynamically, and the size of it was changing dynamically along the way. But the problem can be broken down into pieces in such a way that you can build it incrementally. You can apply agile approaches to it. So I think those are the aspects of the where things are failed. And in enterprise architecture, and we need to think about how do you break down the problems, and add value for our stakeholders and produce decisions, use analysis that goes into decisions, provide alternatives, and courses of action for our leaders, in a very short period of time, in a rapid way. We need to rethink it. We're used to thinking that we have to gather everything. It's just not practical. In reality, there is no enterprise architecture because the architecture of enterprise is always evolving. So there are certain important things, things that we're concerned about standardization, for example, for security purposes. Those are certain constraints that we need to have, and things that we learn about all the time that are evolving. And we need to share those. But we also need to find a way to do just enough, just-in-time analysis, as part of architecture. And I think that's an essential element of the challenges and where it's failed and how we go about, changing it.
So Robert, you just gave a number of examples of some of the challenges with EA and where it has actually failed. So how do you see EA evolving, and what will it look like in 5 years? And you talked a little bit about that, but can you give us even a deeper vision of where you see it in 5 years?
I see it being fundamentally outcome-driven, where there's an initial upfront process that gets people on the same page, we need to know what's important to the stakeholders we're supporting in strategic analysis. We need to know that. And then we need to be very agile in our response. We need to say, okay, given these, and you've prioritized where we should focus our attention, we're going to do analysis that supports that attention, and then we're going to be very agile. We're going to allow ourselves to fail. We're not going to take months and months and months to do this. We're going to, instead of trying to bring all the data into one kind of data warehouse, we're going to go tap it where it is and fuse it where it is. And we're going to be part of a strategic planning group that supports the CXOs, all the C-level and senior leadership level positions of the enterprise. I see it moving within this 5-year period, and there are early adopters of moving strategic, moving enterprise architecture out of the CIO and putting it as an element of the strategic planning initiative for the enterprise. It could be the CMO organization, which within the federal government, they've created as an element of the responsibility of the deputy of the agency, like the chief operating officer kind of role. And in that regard, it's going to be much more analytically focused. It's going to have to involve costs, cost and risk analysis. At least in many of the ways we've traditionally focused enterprise architecture, we have not really tried to become cost savvy or risk savvy or analytically savvy in the sense of the way data scientists might be. Statistically savvy and focused on the data. We're going to have to do that more. And so I see the EA evolving to where we're part of a team of strategic planners that have cost and risk backgrounds, who can do the kinds of analyses that produce that really add value to the mission, to the senior leaders, and say, all right, well, you're trying to make this decision, you're trying to commit resources early on in the process. We're going to help crystallize and you understand what are the implications of that strategy, and is it achievable, and what needs to be done to do that. I see something like an agency stat. That scales up the IT focused portfolio stat idea that the federal CIO and others have brought into place. And it's used to assess mission effectiveness. And it, so it becomes an ongoing tool of the agency, head and of the leadership of the agency or the equivalent divisions and departments to help guide the direction of the enterprise. And so EA will become part of that. And EA as the enterprise architect as the center of the world may change, and that's fine. We'll be a partner in this process. There's certain discipline and rigor and the connectedness of information and the sort of strategic perspective on where the enterprise is going, that remains, and I'll see us using open way of, I call open semantics, where we can standardize on what kinds of information is really important for us to know to support this enterprise mission effectiveness kind of view of where things are going and our simulations and our plans and planning processes. And we'll use that to directly tap the data wherever it resides. I'm not a fan of data warehouses, as you can tell, but I don't think we need to recreate it's impractical. We'll never can do it as recreate that data in one common set of architectural tools or databases, but we can get to a common standard of what we're thinking about in that data, what the content really means. And then we can use analytical tools, cloud-based, things that are very agile and responsive, and we can produce understandable visualizations that make sense to leaders, that really tell them, just by looking at it, where they're going, and what's happening, and what are the impacts of certain decisions, and then let them drill down into the data if they really need to see it. But we do it in a way that we know is architecturally sound, that it's financially sound, and that it's providing good advice to agency leaders.
Now, throughout this conversation, you've talked about some of the challenges, the opportunities, some of the work that you've done. You've given examples of resources that could be used. You've given many case study kind of scenarios of what's working and where it's working and where it's not. I guess this also then sort of hits to the controversies in the field. So can you talk more about the controversies in EA?
Sure. I've talked a little bit about the role of the CIO changing. both a diminishing role to where, in many cases, at least at the lower level CIOs, I mean, there's a thrust within the federal government to basically eliminate the lower level CIOs and give the highest, the CIO, which tends to, the agency level CIO, which tends to be a presidentially appointed kind of position, to give them the role and authority. But that's facing a big cultural change, facing big issues. Traditionally, what's happened is the CIO has never had authority over the IT budget. And so they've sort of been relegated to, rather than controlling and being aware of and helping to guide the use of information as a whole for the enterprise, they've been relegated to focusing on the commodity ITs, the desktops and the iPads and the mobile devices and cybersecurity and data center consolidation and things like that. So IT, Gartner says, and I agree that missions are IT, most agencies have information as an essential element, as a fundamental, and information technology plays an essential role in the mission. And so CIOs, the area of controversy is that CIOs would like to have more authority. They've seen them go away. There's a dichotomy in one study that I read that showing that CIOs care mostly about issues in IT management, but they show this great interest in big data as a technology, not as a decision enabler. So there's a disconnect there. They sort of realize to some degree that they have a role to play in a fundamental strategic way, but they're wary of taking on. I think a lot of them gotten beaten down when they try to take it on. At DOD, they lost the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. They had a major strategic executive that they were responsible. The CIO was basically dual had it. They were the agency CIO and they were a DASD. And they lost the DASD. Well, they lost this big budget authority. They lost a weight, a stick to actually influence the department. So very few CIOs have any kind of budgetary authority. I think the only one that I can think of is the VA CIO, who actually is responsible for IT and across the agency. But what happens then is you get missions like, I'll bring it back to healthcare.gov. Well, there have been some recently publicized major security issues in healthcare.gov. And you need the advisory role of a CIO in these initiatives. But unless the CIO raises their thinking to move themselves out of commodity IT and think about the fundamental role that information and information access plays in the mission itself and how to enhance mission effectiveness, I don't see them, I see them being further diminished. Something needs to take the place. But we need a new way of thinking about, IT as part of the fundamental mission and strategic planning with IT awareness as a fundamental part of mission planning. So that's one area of controversy. Another was the continuous push and pull between having a set of standardized architecture views or views the way we call it in DOD or artifacts that agencies could use. And I mentioned that DOD largely used it to make sure that they were getting products that could talk to each other, that were interoperable, versus the budget reality and the challenges that, that program managers always have to deliver on time and within budget and reduce risk and save money and not invest in things that are largely done for a so-called compliance perspective that are not really used for any value, that don't deliver any value. There's one thing if they're used for something, for like assessing interoperability between specific programs that you know that this component needs to work with or processes, but largely the controversy has been the cost and time to deliver these very large and complex architectures. I know that the business enterprise architecture, DoD's enterprise architecture, was developed for auditability purposes and in response to a number of issues raised by GAO, was in the hundreds of millions of dollars, cost a lot of money to produce, and has the end result, has the value been achieved from it? Well, I don't think the processes are yet auditable, so I'm not so sure they happen. So that's another area of controversy in enterprise architecture. And then another area is that has been a big issue and is continually raised is the inflexibility of government procurement and contracting and how that conflicts with the advancing pace of technology. And then how all of these sit in the context of a budget crunch. So it's a very complex set of dynamics. How do you get effective technology in the solutions delivered to our government and to our citizens and have it be responsive and utilize the most effective and capable components at the same time when the whole contracting model doesn't support it. It doesn't support being agile. It doesn't support being responsive. So that's another area of controversy that architects have had to live with and try to find effective solutions for.
Well, that's a good sort of discussion about the controversial areas.
I probably could go on forever in each of those. You know, each of those is a story in and of itself.
Each is a conference in itself, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Now we're going to go off slant we'd be taking, and take more of a broader issue here, and that is the evolution of EA as a recognized profession. On par with ones like accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics and a discipline process for those who breach it, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials. Do you see this happening? Do you see a need for it?
I certainly see a need for it. It's going to have to, I think, evolve with as the practice evolves itself, which is a bit of a challenge. So for example, we were involved, Binary was involved in helping develop DoD's EA certification level and training, which was done in conjunction with a number of universities, in degree granting organizations, and that was effective, but it was like a snapshot. It was done based on the current thinking about architectures, the current thinking about levels, certain classes of architects. You have folks who may work in specific applications, a specific department level kinds of things, or agency wide kinds of architectures. And so it was done from that perspective. Security architecture can be applied across a variety of different domains. And some of those still exist, but I think they reflect large scale, monolithic kind of approach to architecture. Given that the practice is in flux and it's morphing, there are early adopters that are moving to approaches that focus on more, as I mentioned, more of the strategic and mission-focused approach, and it's becoming very interdisciplinary. You can't do this kind of analysis without some grounding in costs, you know, in risk analysis, in planning as a whole and planning as a discipline, in strategy and in performance management. So I think that the needs of where the enterprise, where the discipline is going are in flux enough that it may be the wrong time that's to set necessarily to establish credentials for things that, that are not, are needed, or have been needed in the past, but not where will not be needed in the next few years. I think that things may move into the business schools, and we may think of a management, an interdisciplinary kind of management curriculum, that where it architecture is blended as a tool of strategic planning, and it's part of the process. It may involve grounding in analytics, in both process and resource analytics, and in data science and simulation, statistics, predictive analytics, and all, and that that's very interdisciplinary, and I think it's going to be hard to find. Certainly, perhaps the way we've done it for the certification and the you know, the quality credentials and accountability considerations would be better off coming from an academic institution or something that is thinking of the management of enterprises as a whole, rather than what we've had up till now, which has been sort of specialized. This is my opinion, specialized, you know, certification and all. So I'd see it moving closer to that, and I think that I, for example, participated a number of years ago in a developing a practicum in world-class quality, and it was done in conjunction with a business school up in Seattle, and it was very interdisciplinary, and we exposed learners to a number of different disciplines, from quality and statistics and cost analysis, and a number of different disciplines, and so they get a very round and architecture and a very rounded way of thinking holistically about how they did problem solving. I think that something like that is really needed, but then becoming, rather than a practicum, becoming a discipline of management science.
Well, Robert, we're down to our last couple of questions, and you know, you're a renowned international notable expert in many areas, one of which is enterprise architecture. And you do a lot of traveling and speaking, and of course you're widely sought because of your expertise. So from all of this work that you've done, your travels and your speaking, do you have any stories that you can share, maybe something amusing, unexpected, surprising, and so on?
Well, I talked a bit about the fact that I spent about 10 years in the Army, not as a soldier, but as a support to the strategic planning and the chief information officer. And what amazed me was how many times we tried to create the One Army Network. There was Network 2020 is one of the latest ones, but there's the equivalent. And I went through four CIOs in that process, and each of them had their angle on it, and it was part of the idea. Now each of them were a very expensive endeavor. As I mentioned, you had to assemble a cast of hundreds of people, highly skilled. You sequester them away. They try to answer some questions, and then it repeated the next cycle over and over again during those 10 years. and for issues like data center consolidation. And the latest from DoD is this Joint Information Enterprise. It's like I start singing the song, you know, when will they ever learn, you know? It's the value of saving and reusing this knowledge about the architecture. It's never been gotten. Perhaps it's because we've all, as architects, said, you know, you have to do it using our tool. That's ridiculous. You know, if you need to change the building to do something new, you need to know what the architecture is. But you only need to know about that. You don't need to know about the whole enterprise. You need to focus in what the need is, what the outcomes are. And, you know, you can't just do architecture for its own sake. So I think we need to capture, the moral for me is capture architecture incrementally in a way that's driven by outcomes. And we need an open way, which is effectively an open architecture for architecture knowledge that allows us to tap into and fuse that knowledge regardless of where it's stored. It's just amazing to me. You know, we see sequestration, right? And everybody, it was chosen because it was the stupidest thing to do and nobody ever wanted it, but it was so they wanted it as a point of last resort. But, as it turns out, it's been harder to do things rationally and correct and, you know, and objectively and come up with ways to change the enterprise of the government, that are effective, than it has been to do the same old, cut 10% or cut 30% off the top of everything. And everybody suffers. The wrong programs suffer along with the right programs. Clearly, we're doing a lot in government that because it's so large, because it's so complex, we can't think, we've been unable to think holistically, and because it's so complex, it's too scary. It's scary to people to think about how do we really change things effectively. And I think that's coming to the fore. It's just maybe it's a fundamental element of what's happening to our culture and our society. You know, as it grows and gets more and more complex, we're reaching a breaking point. And I think we need maybe a new way of thinking about government, you know, that is much more open and collaborative, and we tap expertise wherever it resides. And we've all, anybody who's worked inside of government knows how ineffective it can be. And one of my favorite shows is Yes Minister from the BBC, where those inside the, you know, bureaucracy lambast hilarious stories of how they hold back on doing any kinds of effective change. And that just, you know, we can laugh at it, but it's what's happening to us. We need to find a way to work together, to think about collaboratively about what really matters, what are the outcomes that really matter. I think when people get down to it, and this has been proven, there's a whole field of discipline called deliberative democracy, and there's a group out at Stanford that's pioneered a lot of this work, and it's been used very effectively, where you get people off the street together who basically have very, very differing opinions about how to change things, and you know, it could be the Democrats and the Republicans have had just totally different thoughts about how do you do government. But when you finally objectively share, what's the mission, what are you trying to do, here's what's being done, a lot of these barriers come down, and you can get to effective government. And it's been proven over and over again, and we need to be doing it. So that's one story. The other one I was sort of alluded to a little bit earlier about that happened at Bon Jovi's Soul Kitchen. John Bon Jovi has been very supportive of veterans and of the homeless, and been very generous. And one of the, he has a restaurant. It's actually a gourmet restaurant. It's up in Red Bank, New Jersey. And he brings in people off the street, veterans and people in need, and if they need food, they can come and work in the kitchen and they can get food. And you know, so and basically people who can pay, who can afford to pay. And so it's a very innovative way to offer help to those in need. And what he found was, hey, you know, I can give them food, but what's next? So, you know, where do they go for shelter? Where do they go for mental care? Where do they go for, you know, substance abuse kinds of consideration? Where do they go for medical? So John was a spearhead for this effort called Project Reach, which was, working with the president, working with, federal chief technology officer, came up with this challenge in VA and HUD, Project Reach, which was to build an app to help, as I mentioned, veteran caregivers find local resources which veterans could connect to. So we went up we decided we would try to build an app. We'd take on the challenge, and we went up to Red Bank and we sat down to meet with the manager of the Soul Kitchen. And what happened was, we brought along someone from the local county's social services organization, which we had also, was also the first thing off the bat I called and found, well, who's responsible for how you do services for homelessness, in this area? And the challenge was actually to provide, this app that would work at Red Bank. It would work in that local area as an example of how it could be done. So we did that. And it turned out that the manager of the Soul Kitchen, who came up with a lot of these issues that went into this challenge, had never met the person from social services who worked about, I don't know, 5 miles away. And so we were able to bring the two together, and the guy, for the first time, the manager found out what social services actually did, and that they would help somebody who's in need, regardless of whether they could, you know, really, they were allowed to go into a shelter. Turns out that HUD had all sorts of rules, and the county had all sorts of rules. They were trying to protect the shelter from, like, somebody who had been arrested. It was a molester, or, you know, sexual predator, or something like that. So they had rules, and they were working as to intercede to make sure that the population of a shelter was safe. So you couldn't just, you know, go as a travel reservation system, which was what the Soul Kitchen, the manager there, and the way the challenge was designed. One element was it find a way to where somebody could find out where there are spots available at different shelters in the area, and then connect them with it. Well, it turned out that you couldn't do that. The shelters wouldn't talk to anybody because the rules of the county said that the social services had to be a middleman and intervene and make sure that the safety was being supported, the person wasn't abusing the system, et cetera. But social services would find ways to get people in house. If they had a 24-hour hotline, they would take care of people in the interim. It's not like they weren't caring. It's not like it was some bureaucracy. It was people whose mission it was, who really bonded to the mission to help the homeless, to help those in need. And we broke the ice, you know. That's what's exciting for me is, it all brings tears to my eyes because, you know, they're people who care. And the whole purpose for this challenge was, veterans have come out of a situation where they were a part of a family. And having worked with the military for years and years, you know, it's a family. It's people care about each other. People take care of each other. I mean, it's a large institution, and institutions have challenges, but they're closer to a family than anything else. And then they become a veteran, and they're thrown into the midst of a complex set of non-connected, interdisciplinary, interagency systems, multiple systems, and they say, and navigate them. And then you get things like the backlogs in disability claims processing that came up because of all sorts of new requirements that were being added. New people that they wanted to be able to support, and so the growth in the backlog of claims got really large, and so you want to do something to really help people, and it all comes down to people. It's people to people, and in the midst of technology, can only do certain things. It turns out that really what we're trying to do in most cases, it's just an information system. We're trying to connect people with people, and services with services, and we're trying to meet people's needs. And that, to me, was a great, amazing story that after all this, us from Fairfax County, Virginia, were able to bring these two people together so that they could really finally understand how to best solve the need that they were addressing locally, even though they were just a few miles apart.
Robert, it's clear this is an area of passion for you. I could hear it in your description of what occurred, and I guess there's somewhat even injustice in a way in what's happening to veterans, especially.
Yes.
So I'm glad that you had an opportunity to talk about some of the barriers, the challenges, and in those stories, maybe get the audience involved in making a meaningful having a meaningful difference, taking action, participating, and helping those that are out there who are in trouble or who have need or can be supported in some way. Now, Robert, we're down to our last question, and this one is where I turn the tables, and that is. I'm saying to you, if you were conducting this interview, and we've covered a lot of areas, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Well, okay, I think you recognize I'm passionate about this. I think I might ask, well, why is it a passion for you? And my answer to that is that it's about people and it's about organizations. I've worked in industry, I've worked in government, and I see the same kinds of things happening over and over, and this is our money being spent for these things, and it's just ineffective. Large organizations are ineffective, and when it comes down to it, when people are empowered, liberated to really fulfill their mission. And there are a lot of people in government who are mission oriented. They wouldn't be there if they didn't. Similar to in the military, and to veterans who I'm very passionate about. So it's a passion for me because this discipline can liberate. And if it's allowed to be applied that way, it can break down the barriers and break down the silos and get people to, aha, we're trying to do this, let's just go do it. And that means they're a lot freer than they thought they were. The bureaucracy was just created because it was created. It's not there except to do its mission. So let's make it effective to do its mission. And so that's, I think, asking why it's a passion, why would you expend it in? And then similarly related, why did I go into government versus industry? And I think it was for the service. I had a choice. I'd been in enterprise architecture for about 30, 35 years, and I was an independent consultant, and I had a choice. Basically, I was deciding, well, I'll either go to Boston area and maybe work in some of the technology and financial a lot of healthcare insurance and things like that, or I'll come to DC. And turns out I got hooked up with a friend of a friend with a binary CEO, and I ended up in DC, and I'd worked in DC before. I worked in federal government challenges before, and I think it's a wonderful way to be of service. You don't get as much money, if you get recognition, it may be bad or it may be good, But it's a way to have an impact. And so that was the second question. Why do I choose, why did I choose government versus industry? And the third was, well, how did I get into this in the first place? And for me, I started in software, and I actually started in systems kind of software. I was part of a group focused on a small company when I was going to college that did some pioneering work in nuclear medicine, image analysis with isotopes that help you understand how the body is reacting. And the funny thing was that folks, and I was a pre-med major, and the folks always told me, if you get into computers, you're never going to go into medicine. And they were absolutely right. I got into computers big time, even though it was through medicine, and then I ended up not going into medicine. And what I ended up doing was, all right, well, it's really interesting when you're working with systems and how they interact and software and then take it up to a next level. Well, how do people interact in organizations? And then take it up to the next level. How do governments interact in agencies and fundamental missions and things? And it's really, there's a lot in common going on. And so it was for the challenge and for the service and to help give people a way to get things done more effectively and to that they can, by thinking holistically, by thinking outside the box, by thinking about the problem a bit more objectively, they can get out of some of the emotions involved and get down to, get out of some of the head-to-head fisticuffs and get down to business and get down to missions and get down to service and delivery. And that for me is the passion about it. When people love what they're doing and are serving others and people's needs are being met, that's the whole equation, whether it's an industry or in government. And I just like the challenge. The bigger, I tend to do pretty well with bigger challenges, but it really all boils down to people and serving their needs.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about medicine, but really I see you involved in supporting the health of regions and the country and of government and business and industry and society and consumers and people and those who are disadvantaged. So your framework has actually broadened to a global and multi-domain, multidisciplinary approach. And I applaud you for all of that you've done.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that you taking the time to talk with me and let me share a few things. And if it inspires someone else to take it on and think about the problem, these kinds of problems in a different way, I think that's great. And there's a lot, there are no end of challenges, you know, at every level. And it doesn't really, you know, one's not more necessarily more important than the other. I think everything's all connected in some way, you know, like the butterfly flaps its wings and things happen in chaos theory and things happen across the continent. And there's a lot of interconnected things going on. And, so the more that we do, and the more that we do in a way that fulfills our mission, fulfills our ability to serve wherever we are, helps everyone. So I'm glad to be part of the cog, a cog in an overall scheme of things.
Well, Robert, we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview and share many of your experiences and your history of successes and all of your deep insights and wisdom. And again, thank you so much for sharing your deep experiences with the audience.
Thank you, Stephen, and wish you all the best.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Robert Damashek, Chief Architect, Binary Group, noted International Enterprise Architecture Authority, and Authority in ICT. Okay, that's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Did it meet your expectations?
Oh, it was great. I mean,
okay,
you know, because you're very passionate about what you talk about, and it comes across, and I know that people are going to get a lot of value from all the experiences you've shared. So,
that's great. I appreciate it. And look forward to listening to it and to listening to one you did with Dave and see where it goes.
Okay, well, you take care, and thank you so much, and all the best
to you. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.